Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers. Physics teachers like me, Thomas WP, and I'm joined today face-to-face with Robin Griffiths.
Actually, we're sharing a microphone, so it's a little more face-to-face than I'd like. You could have shaved. I'm just getting terrible stubble burn. I'm Robin Griffiths, and I'm a teacher of physics too. I teach now years 8 through to 13, and we are joined... It's great. We are joined by the wonderful, wonderful Andrew Harrison. Hello, Andy.
Hello there.
And Andy, we both used to work with at our school where we worked together a while ago. And he won't say this, so we have to. Possibly one of the best teachers either of us ever worked with. And he's now working as an outreach officer in London, is that right?
That's correct, yes, for a medical research organisation.
And we have mentioned you on the podcast because we were doing open evenings and we mentioned the infamous egg into the conical flask.
Yeah. I used to love doing that.
The reason we've sort of co-opted you into the podcast here, Ed, is you phoned up all unsuspecting and said, "Oh, I've got a question on some physics I'd like to answer." And we said, "Great, come round." And then when you came round, of course, we shoved a microphone in your face.
Totally ambushed.
Yeah, absolutely ambushed. But you're basically working in outreach and you do a lot of work with primary schools.
Yeah, that's right. So we're trying to support our local primary school teachers with some continuing professional development, CPD. And one of the areas that we find that they struggle with is practical ideas for teaching science, because often they're not science specialists. So we're trying to help them out.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. And we've never actually, and with all of our thing about our podcast being for non-specialist teachers of physics, we've never addressed an episode at primary teachers before, so it would be a lovely thing to do.
Yes, we've not had a primary teacher on, but you're the next best thing, I think. And we got some expertise. I was a primary school governor for 12 years, and Robin is a primary school governor too. So we have been in primary schools. So what do you have for us, Andy?
Well, there's a whole raft of things to do with science teaching in school, but in particular, one that we're looking to do is to give them practical ideas so that they can actually get hands-on with the students. But having feedback from the teachers, one of the things that they lack is good ideas for teaching practical skills in the classroom. And that's either because of their lack of confidence or because of the lack of resources. So we're going to try and help them out with both. Now, one of the things that we really want to do is clarify for them forces, because we feel that this is one area where there's a lot of confusion. And I think I'd have to agree with them. Myself being a biologist, I struggle with this too. So what I'm looking for is a clear steer that we can give the teachers on what is a force, what isn't a force.
Yeah. We had an episode in season one, episode 23, I think we looked at. Which is on forces. So hopefully that's some level of instruction there.
But episode 30. Teaching forces to 11-year-olds.
Series 1, episode 30, which was the one about teaching forces to 11-year-olds, so which is not far off, and so that will have some ideas. And I think, where did we end up with this, Thomas? Our advice on forces was very, very simple, I think, when it came down to definition should be
a push or a pull. And I'd started with a push-pull or a twist, and one of our loyal listeners said, well, you know, isn't that a torque? And they were right. So it's now, a force is very simply at primary school level, a push or a pull.
Which, for me, immediately starts to clarify things. But having a look at the forces that I've got in my head, I still have problems in trying to be able to define just with that, which is what is a force and what isn't. So can I give you an example? So a couple of ones where I think it's relatively clear and easy to help primary school teachers understand would be friction. So friction is dragging something back. It's a pulling force. That I think everybody will be happy with. And I think a primary school teacher, if they had to try and explain it to a child, there wouldn't be too much of a problem. One that I find really problematic is gravity.
Yes. Now, this is interesting because I was having a chat with somebody from the Institute of Physics the other day who was saying that this is a constant source of difficulty, and the idea of particularly the W word, weight, mm-hmm. and gravity, and the fact that when you say to kids, what's the force, they'll say, oh, the force is gravity and things like this, and it is a real difficult one. So I think from my point of view, I don't know if Thomas would agree, but you should stick away from the idea of using the term gravity to describe a force. Gravity is a concept. Gravity is the name of the concept by which two masses attract each other and the force that ends up being exerted on an object is called the weight, or at least that's the current convention. Force due to gravity is fine. Weight is fine. Just saying it's gravity. Gravity isn't a force.
So. Yeah, I'd agree with that. And we didn't introduce ourselves fully. I'm a part-time, A-level mostly, physics teacher. And at A-level, if they were asked to label a down arrow on, say, a helicopter, and they put gravity, you would mark it wrong because you'd say gravity is a field strength, whereas the force caused by that field is we would call weight, or force due to gravity, as Robin says. So, yeah, I agree. It's not a force. It's like a concept.
But am I right in saying that at GCSE, in certain circumstances, if they were to say the gravity, the force of gravity, they would, just according to the BARP scheme, get a tick?
Yeah, they would. And it's just the exam board kind of being generous because they've recognised that they're in the right ballpark and they've learned something, and the exam board's kind of drawn its mark and said, well, that's probably near enough for our purposes. But it doesn't really help, I don't think. I think, you know, physics is about precise terminology a lot of the time, and it'd be really great when you're working with the primary teachers and the primary teachers who are listening to this, we hope, if you can start to get the kids used to using the right term. And the right term is weight or force due to gravity, and gravity is perhaps the wrong term. I think that the parallel I'd go to is cooking. You know, you say, I produce food by cooking it, and I talk about cooking and cookery, but I wouldn't say, oh, that's a nice bit of cooking for when the food turned up or whatever. I don't know. Is that a stretch?
Yeah, you wouldn't see I had a lovely dinner of frying.
Right.
I had a lovely dinner. I had a fried egg, and the result of frying.
Right.
So that would be a sort of an analogy that might work.
Yeah. Yeah. And these analogies, I think, are going to be key for when talking with primary school teachers, because we're going to try and give them the confidence to, if a student was to question it with them, come back with a confident answer of understanding it.
Yeah, I think something that comes up at primary school is magnetism, isn't it? And you can talk about magnetism in the same way you talk about gravity. Magnetism is not a force. Magnetism causes a force between a magnet and a magnetic material, or two magnets. But magnetism isn't a force. And I think, are people less likely to talk about magnetism as a force? Maybe not. I don't know. I do, but it's a parallel argument.
Yeah, I think certainly the difference between magnetism and a magnetic attraction.
Hmm.
Help me out here. There's a difference.
I think so. I think that there's a sense that magnetic attraction or magnetic repulsion, those are descriptions of forces. Magnetism is a description of the concept by which magnetic materials interact with each other.
Right. So on that idea then, if we're talking attraction and repulsion, is that the same idea for electrostatic? Now, I'm not going to use the word force, because what you're saying therefore is that there's no such thing as an electrostatic force?
I would, again, going back to what Robin said about precision, I would use electrostatic attraction or electrostatic repulsion. And we're talking about practical. There's, going back to our first episode, balloons. Yeah, it's a brilliant practical you can do there, isn't there? You just have a balloon and you cut up the paper into little tiny pieces, and then you rub the balloon on something furry, your head, if you've got any hair. I mean, like, work for me, wouldn't it? You two would be struggling a bit.
He went to the no hair thing.
It's a lifestyle choice.
But that's something that I don't know if we talk about the scientific method, don't we? And that's something that's really rich. Things you can keep the same in that, and things you can do differently, and explore the movement of the paper. But the movement of the paper is caused by electrostatic attraction and then electrostatic repulsion.
I think, yeah, this is the weird. So I wouldn't have a problem with magnetic force. And I wouldn't, funny enough, wouldn't have a problem with electrostatic force. I would have a problem with somebody saying, what's the force there? And you'd say electrostatics or magnetism or gravity. It's a gravitational force. It's a magnetic force. It's an electrostatic force. And it's just being precise about what you're talking about. Because otherwise you get the sort of thing of, how do you make a fried egg? You make a fried egg by cooking. Yeah, that's not really helpful. That's just telling me the concept by which I produce a fried egg, the actual idea of what I have to do of breaking an egg into a frying pan and cooking it over a heat. That's sort of a slightly different thing. You know, it's a more precise. So it's about precision of language. And it's just because, I guess, as secondary teachers, we do a lot of mopping up of people who come with misconceptions. And I think that the one that I'd particularly point to is when you talk about electricity, you know, kids talk about, oh, the electricity flows around a circuit. And it's like, well, not really. That's sort of saying, you know, that the electricity is the name of the concept. The whole idea of charge moving in a circuit, that's electricity. But what it is charge moving, forming a current. It moves because there's a potential difference and it flows through a resistance. You know, that's the specific language. And because we end up sort of trying to unpick that language at secondary, it'd be great at primary if we could nail it with electrostatic force, or magnetic attraction, or magnetic repulsion, but not that force's magnetism.
And I think that's one of the key things that when we're giving CPD and trying to help teachers is making sure that that language is clear, but at an age-appropriate level. Because if a teacher were then to ask me, for example, well, why isn't magnetism a force? Then I'm going to struggle, without being a physics specialist myself, in order to be able to explain it in the depth that you've just gone into. So what I'm looking for, and if anybody's listening and they want to help out here as well, is how to phrase this sort of answer to a question of that depth. Because I feel at primary school, it probably isn't necessary to go to that depth. Yes, it's great to get better understanding, obviously, for your own teaching. But in terms of the actual what they need to know on the ground when they're there with the child, that's what I really want to focus on. So it is having clear understanding. So, for example, push or pull force is a force. Great. I think we're getting there. Now, the other thing I really liked was your example of rubbing the balloon on your head and then picking up bits of paper. Because at primary, for the primary school teachers obviously listening, you know the types of inquiry that we've got to teach, things like observing changes over time, noticing patterns, modelling, that kind of thing. And as I said at the beginning, one of the things that we that primary schools often struggle with is having the right kit to be able to do a good quality, simple practical with easy resources. Mm. And that sounds perfect. If you've got any more examples, or if anybody listening has got examples, that would be brilliant.
But I'll come in with my magnetism. Go back to magnetism. I really like just testing the strength of the magnetic field, picking up paper clips, and a tip on that is if you chain paper clips together and put them on like a long snake, it's great fun making the chain, and then you hold the magnet on the last paper clip and see how many you can lift off the table. That's a really reliable way. Yeah. Of measuring how strong that magnet is. Now, at a primary school, you could possibly get the kids to bring in a magnet and then just compare the strength of the force from the magnet picking up the paper clips. It's much better than just having a pile of paper clips and shoving a magnet in it, which will pick up a random number of paper clips. Right. If you have it a nice, long snake and then pick it up and see how many you can get off the table.
Right. I'm going to hesitate in asking students to bring in a magnet because going back to the school we used to teach at, one kid did do that. It was one of those very small, very powerful ones, and he got it stuck up his nose.
Oh, brilliant.
Getting it back out was very painful. Okay. Not for me.
Yeah, true. Maybe fridge magnets.
Yeah, okay. That's a good idea.
I think that would be a good way of doing it, because the funny thing, actually, rare earth magnets like neodymium magnets, things like that, also if they chip, they can, the neodymium is poisonous, so you have to be a bit careful. There's a bit of a risk assessment.
And corrosive, isn't it?
I believe so. It's not good stuff. So who's got the most powerful fridge magnet might be a nice way to, to frame a practical. So you bring in a fridge magnet from home, who's got the most powerful one, and then you work it out.
Unless we get really competitive parents. But okay, I get it. That's fantastic. So another one, when I used to be teaching, certainly at Key Stage 3, which again, is it context specific? So things like buoyancy. Now, I'm starting to doubt myself. I'm going to guess that's not a force.
I would say that's a concept again. And I'd talk about upthrust. You know, buoyancy is caused by upthrust from the water. So a boat floats because, well, this is beyond primary school, but at primary school level, the boat floats because the water pushes up with a force called upthrust. Mm-hmm. Buoyancy is a concept.
Yes.
I think primary would get that. I think that'd be okay. You know, if you sit there and say a ship floats, why doesn't the ship sink? And they'd say because the water's pushing it up, or the water's supporting it in the same way that a chair supports you when you sit on it. I think they'd probably get that idea. And I think you could make that parallel. So I think that's probably okay to talk about. You know, if you asked a primary school kid, you know, what keeps the boat from sinking, they probably would say the water. You say, okay, so the water must be pushing up on the boat because otherwise it would fall through the water. So I think you could do that.
So, and again, when it comes to terminology, being clear in both the student's mind and a primary school teacher's mind who's not a specialist, we've just talked about upthrust. What about thrust? Isn't that the same thing?
Well, thrust is a... So, again, difficult words, because upthrust is used for a buoyant force, but thrust is used for a rocket force. So rockets or jets experience thrust because they throw stuff out the back really quickly, and that produces a reaction force that pushes whatever was throwing forward. So in the same way that when you dive off a swimming platform, the swimming platform goes backwards and you go forwards, that's exactly the same principle as a thrust in a rocket, where you throw an awful lot of gas out of the back of it very quickly, and therefore you experience a forward push, which is called thrust.
Or the last time you went out, Andy, and you were in a shopping trolley with 25 bottles of Coke and you threw them out the back and shot down the road.
I'm glad you said Coke. Good. Excellent. But I'm coming back to the role that I'm trying to fulfil here, which is help the primary school teachers.
Yeah, absolutely.
So would you venture into this area of the difference between thrust, upthrust, because of the context, or just stick to the pull and the push?
I think I'd come at it from some forces have official names. Let's learn them. I don't have a problem with that. I think that would be beneficial to the kids moving forward. You know, you could learn a few names of forces: weight, upthrust, rocket thrust, you could call it.
Mm-hmm.
Different types of, you know, there'd be a small number of forces with official names that I don't think that would be harmful to introduce that, certainly to year 5, 6. Definitely handle that.
And of course, primary teachers who are interested, you know, there's plenty of references online where they can go and read and find out and why, you know, why, because I know a primary school teacher listening to this said that nice Mr. Andy Harrison man, talking to a couple of nitpicking physicists, and he's they would be absolutely right. We are a couple of nitpicking physicists, because that nitpicking precision of language is what prevents a lot of misconceptions creeping in later. So trying to cut those, and physics is all about the misconceptions, so trying to cut those misconceptions off early is really, really important to the future physics learning for those kids, and that's why we're being nitpicky about it. So please bear with us. I do understand it's a really horrible thing, but if we can get them with the right terminology going in and the right thinking about that terminology going in, then that gives them a head start.
Yeah, makes me think of something you were telling me about earlier, about reaction force or support force, and you're seeing more and more support force being used as the force that keeps you on a chair.
Mm.
That you sit on your chair, the weight is pulling you down, the chair's pushing you up, and you stay still. And what do you feel your weight? We don't really feel our weight. We feel what I was calling the reaction force, capital R, but Robin's now educating me that we're getting away from that because of Newton's third law, blah, blah, blah. And that's not primary school, but we're getting away from reaction and towards support force. So when I stand up, I feel two support forces on my feet, which happens to exactly counteract my weight.
Yeah, at Key Stage 3, I would use to talk about the reaction force. Support force, I think, makes more sense, certainly to a primary school student, is the fact that, the chair is supporting me so I don't fall onto the floor. Calling it support force kind of makes sense to me. And you're saying that you're seeing that at what level? A level, GCSE?
So I've seen that in both A level and GCSE recently, and it's good to see, because it is better. Because this idea that people used to have, that Newton 3 to every force there's an equal and opposite reaction, people were thinking that when you had a book on the table, that the weight of the book and the support of the table were the equal and opposite, and that's entirely untrue. When Newton was talking about equal and opposite reaction, he was talking about the fact that the earth pulls on the book with a force of somewhere in the region of 20 newtons, and the book pulls on the earth with an equal and opposite force of about 20 newtons. Of course, because the earth is massive and has huge inertia, the earth doesn't go anywhere, but if you drop the book, it falls, because it has small mass, and so therefore has tiny inertia, and it's accelerated relatively easily, which is the second law. So the whole thing is that the Newtonian mechanics thing got a bit garbled in translation, and people started talking about reaction forces when they weren't, because they weren't the correct pairs. And it's one thing, I think, was it you who said that in one of the episodes, that Newton 3 should have this slightly extra line: to every force there's an equal and opposite reaction of the same type, which would get rid of the confusion.
Opposite in direction and equal in magnitude and type. Yes. Yeah, that's episode 6. The jelly chair episode.
Everybody's jelly chair.
Isn't there anything you guys haven't done? Wow. So what we're thinking of doing for this CPD is just opening it up with a quick starter activity of having the names of things that are forces and the names that aren't forces, and getting the teachers just to talk amongst themselves and separate them into the two piles. And so I'm starting to see now that I had some in the wrong column for sure. So that's good to clarify that. So things that perhaps we might put in there as red herrings, which hopefully they would spot, and it'd be interesting if anybody is listening to this who's a primary school teacher who can tell me otherwise. So things like, we would put obvious things like Newton's kilograms mass. Hopefully primary school teachers would be able to spot those not as forces. But then we've got things like heat. Now, heat is not a force. I can see that. But do you think that would be easy to explain to a primary school teacher?
Yes. I love the way that Thomas has just sat back in his chair there. It's just like, you take this one. Yes, it is difficult, because the thing is that the whole idea of energy is a tricky one. And as we discussed in season 1, episode 19, the whole new energy model, the idea of energy and what it is and what it's about is problematic, contested, and a source of a lot of debate at the moment, because basically the IOP introduced a new way of talking about energy that simplifies it and I think makes it clearer, but it means everybody's having to sort of relearn energy from the ground up, which is making it a source of much grizzling at the moment, which I do understand. I absolutely get that, because I'm back in the classroom now and trying to go the energy. So the energy, what was I saying the other day? Oh, yeah, the electrical energy in. No, the electrical energy transferred at this point. So getting the idea of stores and transfers and getting it right is hard. But it is in there. And the idea of heat as energy and the idea of what energy is and why it's not a force and why it's different and why it's like a currency for forces, that's all there in episode 19.
I think one of our listeners really helped us with this, and we had a bit of Twitter going around. I think we ended up with energy lets things happen. And I think that is a primary school sort of argument. Mm-hmm. Energy lets things happen. It doesn't tell you what will happen. It just lets things happen. It's like it's an accounting method for forces, really. But you know, if I gave you £100 and said, right, go out and go shopping, I'm pretty confident you're not going to bring back a Ferrari. You might bring back potatoes, but it might be peas, it might be carrots, it might be bar of chocolate, could be anything under £100. So energy just is what lets things happen. Yeah. And heat is just something that lets the heat will let an ice cube melt.
Now that's a useful one, because change of state is obviously what we teach a lot at primary school. And that was one of the things in my head of if a teacher came back to me and said, well, hang on, heat will change the shape of an ice cube, rather like a force has changed shapes of things, squashing them, whatever, then I was going to say, what would my comeback be? And I like that. I like the idea that it's something that just allows something to happen rather than causes something to happen.
Yeah, and it's also gravity changing the shape of the ice cube when it melts. It's the other thing. So if you melted an ice cube...
The force due to gravity. The force due to gravity.
It's the force due to gravity that melts the ice cube. It's the force due, and because if you think about the ice cube, if you had the ice cube in zero gravity, if you had the ice cube in a region where there was no gravitational field whatsoever, and you heated it in such a way that it was heated evenly throughout, it would maintain its shape. It would still be ice cube shape at the end, but it would just be a liquid. And that's the thought experiment to go through. I like thought experiments in physics. They work well, but that's the thought experiment to go through.
But it would have its own gravitational field and it would put itself into a ball.
Yes. What would the gravitational field on an ice cube due to itself be? Our answer's on a postcard.
it would definitely be a ball. You see that on the International Space Station where they're weightless. Surface tension will put it into a ball as well.
Yes, it's the surface tension that make it into a ball. But the idea is that the surface tension, that's an electrostatic force. Mm. So it's the forces that basically influence the shape of the ice cube when it melts. It's not the heat itself. The heat itself just allows, as Thomas said, allows it to melt.
Obviously not the electrostatic force, the electrostatic attraction.
Thank you.
I'm learning.
Look at this. I'm not. I'm on the naughty step now.
So I've got one more that, again, I think primary school teachers, and certainly I, have a problem with, and that's pressure. So it's due to a force being applied. Help me out.
Well, again, Thomas has sat back nice and relaxed with his head, leaving this one.
If you like.
Well, that, I suppose I'd say what I would say is that pressure is the idea. It's pressure focuses in on where the force acts. Pressure is the idea. It's a region of interaction. So it's measured over an area at which a force is applied. So the thing I'd always go back to, drawing pins are really useful things to consider when you're talking about pressure.
Mm.
A certain force on a drawing pin will push it into the wall. If you turn the drawing pin through 180 degrees, you'd be mad to put the same force on the drawing pin. Mm. The force is exactly the same in both cases, but in one case it does you damage and in the other case it doesn't. Why is that? That's to do with pressure. It's the force is applied over a very, very small area in the second case and a very large area in the first case.
Yes, I think muddling that with a force is easy, but I see it as the effect of a force. Because in like Robin's example of the drawing pin, it's the same force. The force hasn't changed. The effect has changed. So pressure is the effect of a force.
Gotcha. Yes. No, that makes sense as well. Okay. So on my other not forces thing, side of the equation, I could put, in addition just to my units, for example, of newtons and kilograms, pretty much any energy can go on that side. And that's relatively straightforward. So heat, for example. Electricity can go on that side.
Where would you put that old favourite of primary school kids? Fire.
Ooh, hang on. Right, let me have a think. Well, that can't be a force. It's not a pull or push.
Correct.
I'm going to stop there.
Stop there. That's good. It's not a pull or push. It's not a force. So that's the nice thing about getting reductionist is when you say it's a pull or a push, anything that isn't a pull or a push is not a force. So fire is not a force.
But wait a minute. So, but if I was to set a fire and then you have the little bits of ash, they get pushed up into the air.
So what is pushing the bits of ash up into the air?
So you've got the convection currents because
and what are convection currents formed of?
Particles pushing against the ash.
Yes.
So they are exerting the force, nothing to do with the fire.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Density change is probably a bit beyond primary.
But you could put density in the non-force column.
Ooh.
I don't know if they know what density is, but if that's something that's been introduced at primary, I'm not sure it has.
No,
is it?
It's not. I don't think that's primary. That's more
right.
Year 8.
I remember teaching in year 8, but it might have dropped down to year 7.
I do like your force or false columns. Those are looking good. I think that's going to be good. So.
I would love to be able to take credit for that, but I can't, unfortunately. No, what the heck, I will. Yeah, it's really good, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll probably call our episode for force or false.
Yeah, that is probably will be. I hope with a credit, I think.
Quite right. So if you have, like I say, so this has definitely helped me clarify things, and I love the pull or push. That helps clarify things. So if there's any experiments, any little investigations that are, you know, you or anybody listening might think that are perfect for primary schools where they're not resource heavy, where they really demonstrate the principle and, wanting a lunar lollipop, if they can illustrate those different types of inquiry of noticing patterns or comparative and fair testing, etc., to illustrate all of those, that would be even better.
I know a really good book, Alam Shahar's Recipes for Wonder.
Ooh.
That's absolutely right on that. It's aimed exactly at primary school kids doing experiments with their parents, and there's some really wonderful things in there.
Perfect. Oh, that happy days.
And that's in episode.
Yeah, that's in one of it. And I would say Alam Shahar, friend of the podcast, but it's more podcast stalker of Alam Shahar, isn't it, really, actually? Because we tracked him down and he was so generous with his time because, you know, he's Alam Shahar. He wrote the book. And it is a really good book to look at for these sorts of things. So, I think with a bit of luck, Alam might listen and possibly tweet a few bits and pieces to you. So that would be great.
That would be fantastic.
So there's a call to action, podcast listener. If you have a practical in physics that demonstrates a force in action that demonstrates some of the inquiry patterns that are needed at primary school, that isn't resource heavy, something that might involve a few bouncing balls, some fridge magnets that the kids can bring from home, opening and closing doors, the sorts of things that primary teachers can lay their hands on very easily. Do tweet at us at PhysicsTP or Instagram physics_teaching_podcast, and we will pass those on to Andy.
Or email us, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com.
Email, man, you're so like last century. I'm down with the kids with the whole Insta Snapchat stuff thing type stuff. Anyway, there we go. Yeah, so that's good. So is that a wrap for you, Andy?
Most certainly is. This has been a pleasure and a delight to spend time in your company again. It has been a long time, and hopefully it won't be so long next time.
Well, no, thank you very much. I suspect it will be now that you get ambushed with a microphone every time you turn up. But thank you so much for that. And could I ask a huge favour, another favour, is that when this hits the streets, so to speak, which is hopefully planned to be sometime next year,
you'll
sort of pop back and tell us very quickly about it, where people can access this and where primary teachers can find the resources that you've produced.
Yes, well, that would be more than happy to do so, because the more we can spread the word, the better.
Yeah, because it's a little bit sort of confidential and at the moment about what it is and what it's working on, but all will be revealed, and it looks really, really good. So another fantastic resource on the way to support primary science teaching, and I couldn't be happier. I think that's brilliant.
It's been a pleasure, Andy. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. A bit different this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Special thanks to Andy Harrison, of course, for his time, and we wish him all the success and are very interested to hear what comes from our conversation. I just wanted to say we haven't forgotten Charlie Gilbank. We just haven't been able to squeeze in his latest audio, but he will be back next week, and we hope you will listen then.